About 85 through 88, and he was one of the members who started the Friday Night Stand By Me group of NA in the fall of 85. Our speaker is Jim M. from Ohio.
My name is Jim, an addict. Got all my props up here, my book and my towel and my water. And I'm going to be real short. You guys got a couple, 3 hours, right? We didn't call the meeting anything. It was the Chestertown group. The name came much later, which is cool. It's neat to know that it's got a name. It's neat to know that it's still going. We heard a lot about a fellow who came to some of those first meetings. Much like me when I came in, and probably several of you, we had our doubts whether he would make it or not. But he did, and he sponsored a lot of people, and he's now dead, but his spirit lives on in the people he sponsored and the people that they sponsored, and recovery from addiction continues. Sometimes, I don't know why, people say I'm a controversial speaker, and I generally start out with this, and I'm going to start out with this today because it's true of today. I spent quite a bit of time and effort and prayer and meditation in turning this over, both over the last week or so and also in the last few minutes. So if you hear something that you think helps you, don't blame me. It must have been the prayer. And if you hear something that makes you uncomfortable, don't blame me. It must have been the prayer. Because what I pray for is this. I pray to be relieved of enough self-will and ego that I can be used as an instrument for whatever needs to be said. Now, that doesn't mean that my story changes. It doesn't change a bit. But if I were to tell my whole story, we'd be here for about a year. Because I've been active in my recovery. I've done a lot. I've lived a lot. And just like our previous speaker, I'm grateful to just be drawn air, to be above ground. I've made a lot of mistakes. I've had a lot of joy. I've had a lot of sadness. I've survived it all and stayed clean. I got clean the first time in August of 1978. I got clean after believing, being certain that it wasn't possible. I'd never met anyone like me or anywhere near like me who'd gotten clean, who'd stopped using, who'd changed their life, who was doing anything significantly different than what I was doing at the time, right before I came in. I never met anybody who had been able to change. I never heard of anybody who'd been able to change. Well, maybe they caught a bullet and that changed them. Or ran into a bridge abutment and that changed them. Or were locked down somewhere and that changed them. But not anybody who changed, who lived a different life. You know, I knew some guys who stopped shooting drugs and drank wine. But I didn't see that as any different. Their lives weren't any different. You know? They just were sloppier and didn't steal from me anymore or anybody else, maybe. At any rate, I thought it was hopeless. I thought it was impossible to change. I detoxed in a lockdown mental institution. And I went from there to a treatment center. And at that treatment center, in about my third day, I went to my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And later I found out that somehow, coincidentally, It was the only Narcotics Anonymous meeting that met regularly between Milwaukee and Philadelphia. I got rescued, like has been shared before, because, you know what, I wouldn't even have stayed in the treatment center very long. One of the first things that happened to me in the treatment center was they taught me it was okay to lie. I came into intake and I sat down and they didn't have any funding for addicts. And they said, how long you been an alcoholic? And I started to argue with them and said, well, I, you know, drank now and then, but I wasn't an alcoholic. I didn't do it every day or anything like that. And the guy indicated real soon, real quickly to me, and I caught on quickly, that I needed to say that I was an alcoholic in order for this process to continue. So they taught me it was okay to lie. It was good to lie, as a matter of fact, because I was going to get this safe place to be and change my life. I went into the group therapy meetings in that treatment center, and they taught me that it was okay to lie. You know, we went around the room, and everybody was different. One was an alcoholic, one was an addict alcoholic, one was a cross addict. And, you know, they got to me, and I said, well, I don't know what I am. You know, I did this and that and the other thing, the things that I'd done before I'd recently come in. And they said, well, you're probably a cross addict. And I couldn't figure that out, you know. I couldn't figure out. I mean, I never carried no crosses or had any splinters in my shoulder. I wasn't a cross addict. And they said, oh, well, here's something for you. Maybe you're probably a dual addict. But I didn't go marching along with a pistol held up like this, you know, to turn around and shoot somebody. I wasn't addicted to dueling. And then later they said, well, you're a poly addict. You use many different things. But you know what? I never shot, swallowed, or stuck up my any plastic. Yeah. I went to an NA meeting later that week, and I heard very simply, an addict. I didn't embrace it right away, you know, because I was into people-pleasing. I went through that treatment center. I got voted at the end, oh, I'm good at complying with the rules and doing what's expected of me. I'm highly successful as a student of the environment around me and passing tests with good grades. I was elected most likely to stay sober. I chaired the meeting at the end, you know, go through this 28-day treatment center. You got this big meeting at the end where you celebrate. I chaired that meeting. But there'd only been two things that happened to me there that were really of any significance. The first thing had happened just a few days earlier when the guy with a bunch of letters behind his name, and you know what, I was impressed with that. I was impressed by the fact that he was a rabbi and a psychiatrist and an MD and a PhD and a whatever other letters he had. Sat down with us on the floor in this big auditorium and asked us questions. The first question was, where do you think is the most dangerous place for you to be? He was helping us get ready to leave, go out in the outside world. And people said, well, you know, the bar. He said, nah, you know better than that. You know that that's going to hurt you. I have no place for you to be. And somebody else said, well, at a party at the cop house. And he said, nah, you understand that. You know what's going on there. He said, the most dangerous place for you to be is in a doctor's office. A doctor who doesn't understand your problem. Who you don't tell it to. And this is your responsibility, he said. He said, years ago we started to treat this disease, this thing, this malady, and we all thought it was alcoholism. We believed because that's what we saw. People coming to us to look for a better life who had problems with the drug alcohol. And after a while, what happened was we treated them and made them kind of, you know, got them away from it, and they got better. They went back out. They went to a doctor or something else and got some other kind of sedative, and soon they went right back to alcohol. So we believed that it was sedativism then, because alcohol is a sedative drug, and one sedative is just like another one. He said, then what happened was the late 50s and early 60s came along. We started seeing people with and taking a chance on people with problems with hallucinogenics and other drugs than just alcohol and sedatives, and they got well. And when alcoholics went back out on the street, oftentimes they would start living the same way that they came in behind using other drugs, drugs other than alcohol. And what we came to discover was that once someone with this disease, with this malady, is addicted to one drug, one mood or mind-changing chemical, they're in fact addicted to all mood or mind-changing chemicals, no matter what they prefer. That the problem isn't the chemical, but rather the addiction itself. Now, I didn't quite get there when I heard that lecture. I didn't quite understand, but it put a little bit of a crack in my wall of denial. I got clean the first time in August of 1978. I got clean the second time in November of 1978. I got clean the third time in February of 1979. I got clean the fourth time in April of 1979. And my clean date is May the 29th, 1979. If I'm allowed to survive another week, I'll have 25 years. Don't blame me. I've done everything I could. I've like our previous speaker, I've broken all the rules. Doesn't apply to me. The one thing that I really did right was this. You see, I kept going to meetings throughout that time frame. I kept coming back because you had something that I wanted and I needed. And in the treatment center and at most of the meetings that I went to, I heard the same thing time after time after time. You know, I had to admit from the podium, people would say I had to admit that I was powerless over alcohol or I was powerless over drugs. But I had this malady other than addiction. I understood the English language. And I knew that if I was powerless over drugs or powerless over alcohol, that all hope was lost, that I was right. There wasn't any hope. Because if I was powerless over those substances, they could force themselves on me. They could impose themselves upon me. I couldn't do anything about it. I couldn't either put them down or keep them down. As a matter of fact, I got a vision in my mind about powerless over drugs, powerless over alcohol, powerless over substances. And I shared this for a long time during my early speaking career about being like Gulliver with all sorts of inanimate little Lilliputian syringes and doobies and bottles forcing themselves on me. One of my good friends even made a drawing of it. And if you listen to me later, you'll learn about some things that we're doing in our home group, and you'll be able to access some pictures of that drawing, which is really kind of cool. But that was my vision. And I couldn't surrender to that. I thought all this crap about a disease was just a cop-out. You know, have a little strength of character. What do you mean? I'm here to change. You know? And I couldn't stop using. My denial system was stronger than my strength of character, and I couldn't stop using. But I came back to meetings. I came in and I stuck my chest out, walked in late, walked up to the front of the room and plopped myself down in a big show of, here, look at me, you know. And I chaired meetings. You see, I didn't shoot drugs anymore, so I figured that's as clean as I'm ever going to get, and I never told anybody that I was using, you know, a little Demerol here, a little Darvon there. I worked in treatment, so I had to take that Valium so I could get up and help them sick people in the morning, you know? I don't know what happened in reality, but I remember so clearly how I felt. It was my birthday. You know, I was turning 32 years old. Hadn't been able to trust myself for 2 years. Nobody else grew up in the 60s? Don't trust anybody over 30? Okay, well. And I went to a meeting that night, the night of my birthday, after I'd partied the night before and celebrated. And I was really despondent. I went early. I helped them set up. I sat in the back. I held my head in my hands. And I heard what I'd heard time after time after time before. We admitted we're powerless over our addiction. And somehow it just settled around me. I understood finally what it was that I was powerless over. This need to use, when using was killing me, it was killing me and all my relationships. This need to use, this thing called addiction. All my thoughts and all my feelings and everything about me.